Good evening. At this time, Mel, K2KY, and Dick, K2RIW, start a thing called the TechNet. Major purpose of the TechNet is education, but a little bit of entertainment squeezes in there from time to time. This is a gathering of the clan. Guys get together Sunday nights and help each other learn all the intricacies, or try to learn all the intricacies, of this fairly complicated hobby called ham radio. Typical questions involve things like antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and propagation and the 26 different kinds of ham radio. We try to discuss quite a few of those. There's a lot to this hobby, as you can tell. Therefore, there's an awful lot of information we can share with each other. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins at this time? Please give me your call letters and name. K2RIW, listening.
NCC Mobile, how are
you? Okay, I heard a mobile named Howard. Extremely noisy. Want to try again, Howard?
Yeah, NTGOT, November 2 Golf, Oscar Tango.
Okay, that time we got you, Howard. N2 Golf, Oscar Tango. Who's the next person who would like to sign in?
KC2, UPT, Mike.
Mike with a no. Anyone else?
WS2N, Paul, with a small weekly space report. Good evening, Dick.
Okay, we got Paul with a space report. I think there was a double. Was there someone else there with Paul?
Whiskey, Tony.
Okay, Whiskey, Tony. There's got to be a number in there somewhere, Tony. Is it WW2W? Okay, quite noisy, Tony, but we got you. Okay, I guess Tony is probably number two with a yes. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KC2MDP, and yes, Dick.
KC2MDP, I bet you his name is Steve. He's giving us a yes. Do I have your call, your handle correct, Steve?
Yes, you do, Dick. That is correct.
Gee, I actually remembered one. Okay. So far, when it comes to the yeses, we got Howard, Tony, and Steve. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name at this time. Okay, and you guys got to remind me periodically to give a completely long drop period so that people who sign in by way of the internet have the time to do that. We heard reports last week of a number of people who are not able to check in because we were all a little bit too quick on the switch. So once in a while, we've got to tell people we're going to wait a nice long time and see if anyone wants to sign in by the technical net. Here we go. By the internet. By IRLP or whatever. If you guys want to do that right now, we're going to give a nice long drop. Give me your call letters and name. K2RIW listening. Okay, looks like nobody at this time. And just double checking. Mel, are you there? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, good evening all. Want to see if anyone was checking in. Seems like a little on the quiet side today. Same thing this morning with the 10-meter net. Kind of quiet. I don't know where everybody is, Dick. Maybe they're out enjoying the weather, over.
Could very well be, Mel. Okay, the first person who signed in was Howard, N2GOT. Let's hope that the signal holds in there. You got it, Howard. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, good evening, Dick. I don't have any questions supporting Tony. Tony, you didn't have a question. I should go into future improvements.
Okay, if I understand correctly, you don't have a question at this time. I think you said you were signing in for Tony, and your signal is a bit noisy, and hopefully it's going to get better. I think Tony is the next person who signed in. Yes. Whiskey, go right ahead, Tony. K2RIW.
K2RIW, Staten Island Mobile with Howard. Yeah, I had a question. I remember, a few years ago, there was something we transmitted, I guess the ham was transmitted the first time off of a super conducting antenna. energy into an antenna, you might heat it up, and I don't know how that would affect that if we'll keep doing that. At what point of power? But anyway, in general, I wanted to know if you were able to transmit off into a superconducting antenna, would that affect efficiency? And wouldn't the Q be so high that it would almost act like a crystal with an extremely narrow bandwidth? And how would, as a matter of passive efficiencies, are you looking into? And what type of materials? I know they have low temperature, so-called superconductors. Is anybody working on this type of science back to the net?
Interesting question, Tony. The TechNet's been around since 1982. We're going on our 27th year. That may be the second time in 27 years that anyone has asked a question about a conductor, antenna made out of superconducting materials. That may be the second time. That's a rather rare question, a very logical question, and I think the answer is no. Let me tell you why. Let me give you a couple of words as to how an antenna works, why it works, from my point of view. I've worked for 35 years for one particular company called Airborne Instruments Laboratory, did an awful lot of work with them with reference to antennas, and I retired in 2000 and opened up a consulting business, and the majority of my consulting business over the last 9 years has been designing antennas. So you could say I've worked with antennas more than 30 years, and I don't consider myself an expert, but I consider myself a guy who's had a lot of exposure with antennas. I've picked up a whole lot of rules of thumb that work and don't work. I've seen a lot of things that don't work. I've seen a lot of things that do work. I've seen and worked with superconducting filters on the B-1B program, the B-1B bomber program. There was an experimental program there in which we did use superconducting filter. In the case of a filter, you have the equivalent of an inductor and a capacitor giving you a resonator and maybe a whole series of resonators to give you the right filter function. And in order to get very high Q, you want the inductor to have no resistance. You want the capacitor to have no series resistance. By making these out of superconducting materials in a very small package, you can get a very high Q, very efficient filter. Very small insertion loss, and whatever filter shape you design into it, because your resonators are nearly ideal when they're superconducting. That was the good news. And it was cooled with liquid nitrogen, and when the liquid nitrogen boils away, the filter all of a sudden turns into something that was pretty terrible. But while it was cold, the superconducting filter worked like a charm. So a logical conclusion would be, okay, an antenna has an equivalent circuit that looks like an inductor and a capacitor, and there's also a resistor in there. And you would think that if you made the antenna out of superconducting materials, let me drop for a second. Made sure to drop long enough to, in case anyone else wants to sign in. If you make the antenna out of superconducting materials, logical common sense would say, boy, I'm going to get a lot higher performance out of the antenna, maybe a lot more narrow bandwidth, which, by the way, you usually don't want within an antenna. You'd like the antenna to be more broadband. A full half-wave dipole on 80 meters, 132 feet long, made out of, let's say, 14-gauge household wire, held 30 feet in the air. That antenna doesn't quite make the whole band, 3.5 to 4.0 megacycles, before it hits 2 to 1. It hits more like 3.5 to 1 Viswar at the band edges when you set it in the center. The antenna is a little bit too narrow band. And if you increase the Q of the antenna, it would become more narrow band yet, you would think. I think the answer is no. I'll tell you a couple more words about this one. Also, in the case of an antenna, what is really determining the bandwidth is the fact that the signal that you put onto that antenna, you'd like to believe it just goes walking down that wire and jumps into space. Well, that's not what really happens. Every real antenna that we work with, dipole-like antennas, have to first be resonated before they can radiate. What does resonated mean? It means that the energy you put onto the dipole is going to bounce back and forth something like 20 times before that energy finally is put into space. Radiation is hard. It doesn't happen on the first pass.
You have to kick that signal in the tail 20 times in a row before it finally leaves the wire and finally goes into space. And what you and I call resonance is setting the wire the right electrical length so that that signal that bounces back and 20 times, bouncing back and forth, stays in step on all of those bounces. That's what resonance really means. There's energy bouncing back and forth between an inductor and a capacitor equivalent, and you want all of those bounces to stay in phase. If you make the wire a little bit too long, the energy goes down to the end of the wire and comes back a little bit late compared to the next cycle that's being launched by the transmitter. You and I call that inductive reactance because the current is lagging the voltage you put in. It really means it's lagging because the signal is going down a longer length of wire and coming back too late to be in step, to be in phase. The reason you want the energy to be in phase on all of those bounces is so that the current builds up. When the current builds up,
repeater, time out.
When the magnitude of the current builds up, you're creating a stronger magnetic field. It's the magnetic field that really gets radiated, in my opinion. Not everyone's going to agree with that. But the strength of the magnetic field that you create within the antenna is one of the major factors that gives you the ability to radiate energy. Many of us, when we first learn about ham radio, think that the electrons you put into that antenna are going to boil off and go into space. Not one single electron leaves that antenna. That's the hard thing to believe. And so you've got to resonate the antenna radiating structure. That really means the antenna, the transmission line, the matching box, the final stage of the transmitter, the Pi tuning network. All of that has to hit resonance in order to get efficient radiation. The radiation, when you finally get it, is a magnetic field that couples energy into space. That becomes an equivalent resistor. There's no real resistor there. I can put 1,000 watts for 10 solid minutes, key down, into that dipole antenna of yours and mine. 132 feet of wire on 80 meters, for instance. 1,000 watts for 10 minutes. That's a tremendous amount of energy. 10 minutes is 600 seconds, 600 seconds times 1,000, that's 600,000 joules. 0.6 million joules of energy I'm going to put into that antenna if I pour 1,000 watts into it, key down for 10 minutes. Tremendous amount of energy being poured into that antenna. I turn off the transmitter in 10 minutes, walk over there and touch the wire, and it'll be almost ice cold. The antenna is already running at near 100% efficiency. Any antenna that you and I use where the antenna itself is low in efficiency, the only mechanism I know of where the antenna itself, not counting the environment, can be low in efficiency is that it takes some of your valuable RF energy and turns it into heat. It can only do that if there is a real resistor somewhere in the antenna. A resistor across the circuit of, you know, the feed point, or a distributed resistor along the wire. You use quality wire, large enough in diameter, and it's not super rusty steel, if you know what I mean. You get 99.9% efficiency. Therefore, cryogenically cooling the antenna cannot change its efficiency. It is all...
Repeater, time out.
W4NY. W4NY recognized. And we're going to get to you in a second, for instance. W4. November Yankee, I think that was. And I'm going to turn it over to you for some comments after I finish my little spiel here. And that is that the antenna is already running at near 100% efficiency within the antenna itself. Now, when I say within the antenna, I mean I'm not yet counting the environment. Depending on what is the resistivity of your soil and how close the antenna is mounted to your soil, some of the RF energy coming off that antenna is going to go into the soil, heat the soil, make the worms hot, warm in the wintertime, they're going to be kind of happy, and that's going to lower the radiation efficiency of your system. And of course, we're not talking about cryogenically cooling the dirt around your antenna. We're talking about cryogenically cooling the antenna itself. So I think there is little to be gained with a superconducting antenna. The radiation resistance would be the same. The resistance of the wire is not significant. The efficiency increase you want to get is not going to change because it's already near 100%. And whether or not the wire itself is cryogenically cooled or not cryogenically cooled, how much energy you put onto that wire gets radiated into space is strictly a function of what current you're able to launch into that wire depending on what resonance phenomena you've got with it. I think you see where I'm going here. I'm not positive, but I've got a pretty strong gut feel that cryogenically cooling the antenna is not going to change its radiation characteristics, not going to change its efficiency, not going to change its Q, not going to change its bandwidth. That is my prediction. I wouldn't stake my life on it, but I would put 90% of my money on it based on my previous experience. W4NY. Start off with your name, sir. It sounds like you've got a comment or a question with reference to this one before we pass it back to Tony. We're not passing it back to Tony yet. Whiskey4NY, start off with your name, sir, and what is your question or comment? We'll wait long enough for you to come back on the Internet.
W8YY.
Joe recognized. One more call, W4NY, who checked in. You do have a question or a comment. Go right ahead, W4NY. Okay, Joe, maybe you're looking at the list of the people who signed in by way of the Internet. Whiskey Alpha 2, Romeo Yankee Yankee. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I'm checking in to let you know that the node for Glen Oaks is offline, so you're not connected to anything else but yourself. If Route East isn't operating, you can't hear them, and they can't hear you.
Okay, so maybe the W4NY was a person really signing in locally. So, as you can see, Tony, you've got a very modern technique when it comes to exotic electronics these days is cryogenic cooling or superconductivity characteristics. There are some high-temperature superconductors that, as the material research scientists do their thing, a few people are predicting that higher and higher temperatures will be realized where you can start getting superconductivity. Right now, I think a superconductivity is occurring at numbers like 120 degrees Kelvin, where 77 or so Kelvin is liquid nitrogen. So quite a few degrees warmer than liquid nitrogen, you can now build materials that will be superconducting. And in theory, you could do that with an antenna. When it comes to transmission lines, when you're trying to send signals 1,000 miles across the United States, power transmission lines, if there's a way of inexpensively cooling them to make them run more efficient, because there the accumulated resistance starts becoming darn significant because you've got a whole lot of lint to worry about. But you're in my antenna in our backyard on HF frequencies all the way up to VHF and UHF frequencies tend to be near 100% efficient based on that thermal test I told you about. So I think there's not much to be gained with conventional antennas. Now, if you start making ultra-miniature antennas, squeezing them into small packages, there is a slightly different case to be made there with superconductivity. But I'm not trying to go there yet, because I don't think that's what you had quite in mind. Whiskey, Whiskey 2, Whiskey, K2RIW on the TechNet. You got it, Tony.
Yeah, before I go on, this is WSGW with Mark. Are you copying me okay, over?
Yes, I'm copying you reasonably well. A little bit noisy, Tony, but I'm getting every one of your words. Go ahead.
Yes, okay. I'm thinking back. I'm kind of hoping that wasn't an April issue of QST, but the antenna that I saw in the article was kind of small. And like you said, a lot of antennas are modeled on a very high frequency, you know, at a small scale. That's another thing. You said that they make LC resonators for military construction, and that was interesting also. But yeah, I was wondering why I haven't really heard much in the way of superconducting antennas, but I have seen stories, even on the news, about superconducting cables for power companies, because the losses add up monetarily. The last thing you brought up was antennas that also have lump constants in their circuitry, you know, for sure in the antennas, and I thought they may work for that type of thing. Let's say if you want to make a 2-meter antenna, only 4 inches high for some reason, then you could cool the coil. That may help a bit, but my main worry was, or question was about how sharp these things end up resonating, and if inputting power at some point would warm them up and you have more of a problem cooling them, that type of thing. So to answer most of my question, and the idea of the power band bouncing back and forth, almost like putting soldiers on a bridge, and you'd have to break step, but if you make them step in resonance, you get the bridge going, so to speak, in that type of way. So back to Ned, thanks for your response, whiskey to whiskey.
Yeah, you've got the right idea when it comes to the resonance of a marching troop going over a bridge. There they can set the hold-on bridge in motion and possibly exceed its maximum loading on one of those swings of the bridge due to the guys all marching in step. And you're doing something similar to that when you and I build an antenna. And if I built a 2-meter antenna that's only 2 inches long instead of 19 inches long, it would ordinarily have very narrow bandwidth. If I use the right materials of the antenna and the right materials of the loading coil or the impedance matching network, I could get 99% efficiency if I use the right materials. So therefore, cryogenically cooling them wouldn't change the efficiency even of a 2-inch long 2-meter antenna. And the resistance you and I talk about when you see the equivalent diagram of a 2-meter antenna, for instance, that equivalent resistor that's in the diagram is not a real resistor you and I can go out there and measure with our ohm meter, or it's not a resistor that you and I can sense by putting 1,000 watts into the antenna and finding out what gets hot. And by the way, one of the things that I do professionally, quite frequently, whenever we build a super small exotic antenna and squeeze it into some tiny little corner, and we suspect it's not giving us good efficiency, because we measure the radiated signal, we measure the apparent gain, we're not happy with the numbers, one of the first things we do is to pour a watt of energy into the antenna. When they're small, you can do that, and look at it with a thermal imaging camera. The thing that's eating your lunch, the thing that's wasting your power and lowering the gain, will show up immediately as a hot spot on a thermal imaging camera. Let me drop. So immediately you're going to know where the inefficiency is occurring, if there is one. And believe it or not, once your antenna is resonating and giving you reasonable standing wave ratio, that's a fancy way of saying you pour 100 watts into the antenna and less than 1 watt comes back to you, 99 watts is going somewhere. And if that somewhere is not heating the antenna itself, the only thing left is it's being radiated into space. And once you radiate a signal into space, it gives you an energy loss of the antenna, which you write down as a schematic diagram as an equivalent resistor, the so-called radiation resistance or radiation resistor. In other words, the energy you send out into space that spreads out in all directions away from your antenna acts like a resistor, but there's no real resistor there. Nothing is getting hot. If you put a spherical absorbing surface around your antenna, you could measure how much heat is getting across each square meter of your absorbing surface. You could find out that a signal was radiated and it absorbed by your anechoic material, and then it got turned into heat, and that would be a way of confirming the fact that you really did radiate that signal. Since there is no real resistor, even in that miniature 2-inch antenna that you gave as an example on 2 meters, since there's no real physical resistor there, there's nothing to be gained with cryogenically cooling or superconducting that antenna. Good sounding idea, but in the case of a filter where you've got individual resonators, let me drop, a real good filter design consists of individual resonators, LC circuits or their equivalent. They may be cavity resonators in the case of a duplexing filter, but every one of those individual elements of a filter are shielded, because in that case you do not want radiation to take place. You want all of the energy of resonance to stay within the shielded structure so that you get the real tuning characteristic of the filter. In that particular case, cryogenically cooling the elements of the filter can raise their Q tremendously, can increase the performance of the filter even though it's in a small package. So in the case of a shielded structure, superconducting those components can definitely give you an advantage. But in the case of an unshielded thing called antenna, where we're radiating the signal into space and there's an equivalent resistor there which sucks up 99% of the energy, you can see now that cryogenic cooling really doesn't buy you anything, because you're not cryogenically cooling space. And even if you did, that wouldn't gain you anything, unless it is a dipole mounted very low above ground and the ground is absorbing energy. And if you had the resources, yes, you might consider cryogenically cooling the ground. There's an easier approach, I would spread a bunch of screening on the ground so that the RF energy can't get to the dirt, and now I've made the antenna efficient again. I may not like the radiation pattern I get out of that dipole above a reflector, but I can stop the ground from absorbing energy, and laying down screening would be a lot easier than to try to cryogenically cool all the dirt in your backyard. I'm just giving you a bunch of possible alternatives here, Tony. Back to you, Tony, for any final. Darn good question. And a little bit off to one side, and you're the second guy in 27 years to ask a question like that. WW2W for any other comments. K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, whiskey, whiskey, whiskey. Okay, I think I have what you're saying. Resonator in a closed space, you know, closed enclosure, I should say. You know, at cryogenically cooled to be equivalent to hitting a crystal glass with a spoon. You hear the ping. But an antenna would be like hitting the glass with a spoon, and you wouldn't be able to ping as nicely because space could be the equivalent of putting a sponge inside the glass. That would be the radiation resistance. Over.
You got the principle, Tony. You see what's going on. You and I design an antenna not to hold the energy there like you do in a cavity resonator. A tuned filter, we make each of the stages of the filter shielded so that they don't radiate energy. In the case of an antenna, you and I are doing the exact opposite. We intentionally are trying to spread that signal into space. Therefore, we're losing that energy. Therefore, it acts like an equivalent resistor, but there's no real resistor there. It lowers the Q of the antenna. It's the equivalent of putting a wet sponge in your glass that you're trying to ring by, rubbing your finger across the perimeter of the glass or tinging it with a spoon. And so you're absolutely right. In that case, I could cryogenically cool that glass, but if I've got that warm sponge in there absorbing the energy, and that's what's going on with an antenna that radiates, you're not going to gain anything by making it superconducting in that case. Good question. Let's go on to the next person who had a question, and I think that was Steve, KC2MDP. Hope Steve doesn't have one quite as tough as that last one. Over to you, Steve, K2RIW in the second ad.
Yes, very good, Dick. Now, mine is fairly simple. I actually have two questions, if that's okay with you. One is really simple, and the other one might be a little more complex. So I'll give you the first one first. I picked up a Tektronix oscilloscope. It's model 2201. And I would imagine there's got to be some sort of light that lights the bar graph. Before I take this thing apart and basically destroy the thing, would you have any idea how to change the light in there, if there is any, and, what kind of bulb it is? That's question number one. And question number two is, I have a duplex filter for 900 meg that I want to eventually put together a repeater. My only problem is tuning this thing. I also have a signal generator, and I was wondering if I could take the signal generator, tune it to my frequency, and basically use like a watt meter or something to get the maximum wattage out of the duplex cavity filter. Would that work, or do I need some really sensitive equipment to do this? Back to you, Dick.
Okay. I've owned and still own a number of Tektronix oscilloscopes, and the grid on the front panel falls into two categories. In one case, it's a plastic bezel in front of the cathode ray tube, which is being edge illuminated by one or two light bulbs, and most of the Tektronix scopes that I've worked with that have a real cathode ray tube, most of them have this plastic thing with the grid on it, the square centimeters, and if you loosen the screws on the front panel in the right place, you can remove the metal face that's around that plastic thing, and you'll see something like a number 63. It's usually a 6.3 volt filament light bulb with a bayonet base, and there's usually one in each corner. That's the old-fashioned technique for lighting. Some of the slightly newer Tektronix scopes, the grid is built into the phosphor itself, and there's an internal illuminator that lights up the phosphor and shows you the grid. That's a slightly more modern one. And the third kind of Tektronix oscilloscope are the ones that now have a digital display screen where the grid is really built into it by way of a computer program on the so-called display matrix. I'm not sure, but I'm going to make a guess that a 2201 might be the first kind, the one that's got a real piece of plastic in the front where you'll eventually, by taking apart the right portion of the front panel, you'll be able to get down to that light bulb, which is known to be a replaceable item. Do you think there is a real plastic grid in front of the cathode ray tube? If there is one there, give me a couple of words on that one before we go to your second question. Back to you, Steve, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, yes, I was just looking at it, as a matter of fact. There is a plastic grid on it, and it's like a plastic bezel around the grid, and there's like two screws at the bottom there that looks like that whole plastic bezel comes off. I guess that's what I have to disassemble there to change the bulbs. Back to you.
From what I'm hearing, Joe, it looks like it fits into the first category. And even if the oscilloscope has got some kind of a guarantee on it where you were told that if you open up the package, you're going to avoid the warranty, don't worry. We amateurs, we open up everything we own. And don't worry, there isn't a scorpion inside with a year's supply of food. There's nothing that's going to hurt you. So just don't be afraid to take it apart. To take apart the top cover to look inside, to take apart the front cover to look for those light bulbs, and the light bulb illuminating circuit. Sometimes those two light bulbs are in series. If one of them goes out, they both go out. Once you get down to the bayonet light bulb, which is a replaceable item, I think you'll be in very good shape, and the model number printed on the bulb itself will tell you how to replace it. So I've replaced a few of those. It's fairly simple, and you can't get into very much trouble. Not to worry. Even with the cathode ray tube turned on and displaying a picture across the screen, all the high voltage on modern-day oscilloscopes is all internal to the glass. They don't have any of those metal outside tubes like they used to on the early television sets where you touched it and you're touching the high voltage. It's fairly safe. I will admit, if when you take the top cover off the oscilloscope, if it's the kind with a cathode ray tube, and you open up the high voltage cage while it's running and stick your hand inside there, now you're pushing your luck. But shy of that, they're pretty safe. And most of the modern-day oscilloscopes have very few tubes inside anymore. There may be a high-voltage rectifier for the high voltage and a cathode ray tube, and the rest of it is all transistorized modern-day scopes. Okay, when it comes to a duplexing filter, let me drop. Let's assume now that I've got a real good duplexing filter intended for repeater service, in which case it might have three cavities that are tuned to the transmitter frequency and three cavities that are tuned to the receiver frequency. They all come together at one common key connector that goes to the antenna. The three cavities that go to the receiver, of course, go to the receiver, and the three to the transmitter go to the transmitter. When it comes to aligning the transmitter section to get a preliminary alignment, by turning on the transmitter and adjusting those three cavities to get maximum power output, that gets you into the ballpark. Doesn't give the ultimate tuning, but it gets you into the ballpark. By way of your signal generator, apply to the antenna port, and now you watch the receiver sensitivity while you tune the three cavities of the receiver section of the duplexing filter, the other three cavities. Again, you can tune them for the lowest insertion loss and the most sensitive receiver response, where you can turn the signal generator down to the weakest, and or you can be watching the AGC voltage of the receiver while you tune those three cavities. Again, when you tune the receiver in that manner, on the receiver frequency with the signal generator, you'll be in the ballpark. But there's a catch now. Getting into the ballpark on the three receiver cavities and getting into the ballpark on the three transmitter cavities is nice. It is nowhere near home plate. I'm going to describe what home plate is. Once you hit the tippy-top tuning characteristic of the three transmitter cavities and the three receiver cavities, you will then be doing the following. With a good load on the antenna port, with the transmitter turned on at full blast, running 50 watts, we'll say, the amount of transmitter signal that gets into the receiver will be about 120 decibels weaker. If you were trying to listen for a null in the response and you wanted a 20 decibel or a 30 decibel null, with a power meter, you could get that. With an oscilloscope, you wouldn't make it. With the receiver, maybe you can do that tuning by listening to the receiver desensitization while tuning the cavities. What I'm getting at is, when you finally get off
repeater, time out.
W4NY with a comment.
I think that was W4NY with a comment, and we're going to get to you in a second. In order to get all six cavities tuned just right, so that you get that 120 decibel null of the transmitter frequency being nulled into the receiver port, so that your receiver is not hitting desensitization. To do that with just a signal generator is tough. The right way to do it is with a real high dynamic range display device of some kind, like a spectrum analyzer. I'm even skeptical as to whether or not a good network analyzer nowadays days can do that. It's a bit of an art form to really get the best alignment of a duplexing filter so that your receiver does not get desensitized. What I'm worried about is that if more than a few microvolts of the transmitter signal, which is running 100 volts, if more than a few microvolts of the transmitter signal gets into the receiver will be partially overloaded. When the receiver is partially overloaded, it starts making intermodulation distortion. It starts finding phony signals that don't really exist on the band, and you get some scratchy noise, and you get a bunch of disadvantages. So proper alignment of a duplexing filter is a bit of an art form, and it does require state-of-the-art equipment and a bit of extra knowledge. Now, it's not going to blow up in your face. It's not going to catch on fire if you do the tuning like you described. Just that know ahead of time that it's a very tough thing to do. You'll be in the ballpark, but getting to home plate is very tough. W4NY, if I got your call letters correct. And if so, correct me and give us your name and then your comment, sir. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
It was probably me being up and you couldn't hear me that quickly on something else. W-A-2-O-Y-Y, name is Joe. I have a comment for what you're discussing right now. Would you like to hear it?
I sure do, Joe, because I think you've aligned a number of duplexing filters. I wonder how easy you found it. Did you have some unsuccesses at first? And how did you finally solve the problem? Tell us how you did it, Joe.
Okay, the first comment I'm going to make on what you're describing here is probably not a good idea. And I ask the people at Self-Sodge to make one of the people I think RFS to Self-Sodge, and so whether it came RFS to duplexers. They don't suggest you tune the duplexer to power applied to the duplexer and tune it that way. What you're liable to create is arcing within the duplexer as you try tuning it. Not a good idea. First of all, if you've got the duplexer completely out of tune, you're going to have a tremendous VSWR coming back to your transmitter. You're better off using a very high-powered signal generator that's capable of putting out 0 dBm, plus 10, plus 20 dBm, and either a spectrum analyzer or a sensitive receiver to start off getting the pads tuned in the right segment. If they're separatable, where they're coupled with cable between the cavities, tune one cavity at a time, and you'll have a much better, you'll get a much faster in the ballpark. Tuning with power supplies is not a good idea. It is tricky, and you need very good test cables with very good isolation so you don't have interstrait radiation between the cables getting into your generator and receiver. It can be done. I've done it myself. I usually use the spectrum analyzer to do it with a receiver. But I've never done one by putting transmitter power into the duplexer of these ports. Better off doing both ports with a signal generator of fairly high power and some sort of sensitive device at the other end to know what you're doing at the same time.
Okay, Joe. So you're recommending don't put full transmitter power into the duplexer, because if the cavities are highly mistuned, the resonant voltage within a cavity could be enough to arc it over, and there's a slim possibility you can do some damage. If I had the ability to cut the transmitter back to the 1 watt level when I'm tuning the three transmitter cavities, do you think I'd still have a problem of using that as a method of getting into the ballpark of the tuning of the transmitter cavities? Back to you on that one, Joe.
Well, looking at it this way, 1 watt is plus 30 dBm, so if you can even reduce it further than that, to like a tenth of a watt is plus 20 dBm, you're right in the range of 6 generator. I don't know if you really can create as much of a problem with 1 watt compared to putting in 50 watts or 100 watts, but certainly a much safer idea to do what you said suggested, than using full power. And you're much less likely to damage your transmitter by putting 1 watt in and getting, you might start off getting 1 watt in, and having maybe 3/4 of a watt reflected right back to the cavity because they're extremely out of resonance.
here, Steve, properly aligning a duplexing filter is more than first meets the eye. It is a bit of an art form, and I'm checking on something right now. I'm going to give you an answer in a second. Sure enough, there's a guy named KC2MDP who lives in Baldwin, New York. He's a member of LIMARC. That gives him immediate access to a guy named Andy, WA2CDL, who has the kind of test equipment and has the experience of aligning duplexing filters. You have access to Andy, and therefore the tuning of your filter is almost a given, as I see it, Steve. You just hand him a six-pack. Well, he's not a drinker, but you know what I mean. You bring him some kind of a little gift. You hand him your duplexing filter. You speak to him in soft, soothing tones, and I think you're going to get an answer. And watch him do it, because it's quite an educational process. KC2MDP, I hope you enjoy this. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Yeah, you have me laughing here. I have dealt with Andy before, and I've watched him, and he is a wizard at his work. That's probably what I'll do, but I would like to play with this thing. You know, like you said, maybe I'll get into the ballpark. You know, I'm certainly not going to put it to service, so I'll have Andy look at it. The only thing is, with this, I was curious. The one fellow answered my question to him one at a time, which I sort of had a funny feeling that's probably the way I'd have to do it. The only thing is each can has got, you know, it's got a rod in the center, and then it's got one off to the side. Now, I would imagine the one in the center is like your main tuning, and I guess the one off to the side is like a fine tuning. Is that correct, Dick? Back to you. Negative.
Okay, somebody just told us negative. In some designs, one is coarse tuning and one is fine tuning. In other designs, you've got your main rod, which is resonance. You've got the other resonator off to one side that, when properly adjusted, gives you the deep notch on the other frequency. See, when you're transmitting at your transmitter frequency, you want a deep notch on that frequency into the receiver channel. The person who said negative, give us your call letters and name, and give us your words on that subject. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
W2RIY again. Most of the time, that is the notch control. I'm not sure what type of duplexer that you're playing with, but most of the self-size products, self-size, RFS products, that smaller stem on the side. The size of the duplexer is typically the notch adjustment. You adjust the pan first, and then you adjust the notch. You adjust the pan first and then adjust the notch, you do not touch the pan anymore, because if you do it that way, you go back and say, oh, well, I'll just tweak the pan, you'll move the notch tremendously, quite a bit. The notch is very sensitive on most of the questions, even on the pan. The notch is a little bit tight, move the pan very slightly, it makes hardly any difference on your pan frequency, it's right at 4. So it's great to move your notch frequency up or down when you want it.
Okay, a little bit noisy, but as you can tell, Joe is telling us that that extra tuning off to one side is the notch adjustment, that in theory you don't retouch the center frequency adjustment of the main rod of each of those cavities. There's interaction between the two, and it can drive you crazy. There is a specific tuning order that's supposed to be followed in order to get the highest performance. A good duplexing filter will give you more than 120 decibels of isolation between the transmitter frequency and the receiver frequency. That's an extremely deep notch. There have been six cavity filters that have hit not 120, but 140 decibels of notch, in which case, as long as everything is well shielded, you can have a receiver of a duplex, of a repeater that experiences extremely little or no desensitization. You get a hell of a lot more linear performance out of it when you get that real peak adjustment. Just to give you in context, 120 decibels of isolation is a nice number that rolls off the tongue easily. When you really figure out what that is as a power ratio, it is 1/1,000,000, or you could say it's 1/1,000,000,000. In other words, the amount of energy you're putting into the transmitter port of a duplexer versus how much leaks into the receiver port, they should be separated by a million to one ratio. And it takes some pretty exotic test equipment and a little bit of fancy test procedure in order to be able to really see that. Some of the problems you run into is just the leakage of the cabinet on your spectrum analyzer can give you a sneak path for the signal you're trying to null. It's a bit of an exotic process. Believe it or not, when you properly align a duplexing filter, one of my recommendations is that the final peak alignment should be done on station. By that I mean with the
repeater, timeout.
With the repeater set up the way it's going to really be run. If you're going to run it in the garage of your house, you set it up in the garage, you connect it to the real antenna, you connect everything in the cabinet the way it's really going to be laid out. Because there are times where proper alignment of a duplexing filter is location sensitive. In other words, you may have a slight leakage of one of those jumper cables or whatever. So there is some local environment that can actually create a contaminating function here. Where people really run into trouble is, say, for instance, they decide that, gee, my repeater has got 20 watts of output. I'd like it to have closer to 100 watts of output. So you add a brick amplifier to the output of the repeater. Sounds good. You do that, and you're in a hell of a lot of trouble. You take a Mirage, a brick amplifier, for instance, a Baker Baker 1016 or something like that, and you simply connect it on the output of the transmitter and going into the duplexing filter. One of the things you don't realize is that that Mirage amplifier, when it's creating, let's say, 150 watts on its RF output, at the exact same instant of time, it's creating about 3 watts of RF energy that comes roaring out of the 12-volt wire that's feeding power into that amplifier. In order to make it rated for repeater service, you'd have to put some extremely expensive bypassing filters on the B-plus input. You'd have to also do heroic things to the cabinet to make it better shielded. The leakage of energy coming out of the 12-volt lead on that brick amplifier is going to go spraying all over your cabinet. It's going to walk into the B-plus wiring, the power supply wiring for your receiver, and it roars into the receiver by getting into the back door, as they say, and desensitizes the receiver. You'd be amazed how many people have added a simple amplifier to their repeater and all hell broke loose. So to really get the isolation you're looking for is no easy task. And that's one of the reasons why you'll hear a number of people who, after a lot of grief, give up entirely and build a split repeater where there is one antenna for transmitting, another antenna for receiving, and those two antennas are separated by 20 feet along the vertical height of the tower where they're mounted in order to create the isolation.
Repeater, timeout.
In order to create that 120 to 140 dB of isolation, because getting it in the real world on a common antenna is really not easy. And the slightest little bit of rusty bolt within the vicinity of that antenna, the slightest little solder crack on the individual elements of the collinear antenna itself inside of that fiberglass radar, the slightest little crack being waved in the wind will take your transmitter signal, create side bands that are only 100 dB down, 600 kc away on 2 meters, and you'll get the scratchies in your receiver. You're actually modulating the signal in a scratchy manner, and 600 kc away, the side bands you're creating are killing your own receiver. You can see that it's really pushing the state of the art of transmitting and receiving simultaneously with one antenna, and you're really asking that duplexing filter to perform some magic. And it gives you a little bit of a gut feel as to why that alignment to get full performance out of it is no easy trick. Even with the right test equipment, there's a significant learning curve to properly tune one of those things up, but as I see it, Steve, I'm not trying to scare you. Don't be discouraged. Go ahead and try it. For the most part, you're not going to damage anything. But don't expect full performance right out of the box, if you know what I mean, because you're going through a learning curve, and what you're trying to do doesn't come easily. The number of people in this club with 300 and some odd members who've got the skill to do this, I can count them on one or two fingers. KC2MDP, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yes, very good, Dick. No, I don't expect full performance. You know, I always say three quarters of the fun is the learning of the project you're doing. So, yeah, I'll probably play with it, and, you know, like you said, I certainly can't blow it up, and if I do, it wouldn't be the first thing I've blown up. So, you know, well, give it a shot. I appreciate the info, Dick, and back to you.
Yeah, nowadays there are a whole lot of cell site 600-watt amplifiers and 300-watt amplifiers and 150-watt amplifiers that for the last 5 years have been on the Internet at very attractive prices. I've got two of those in my hands right now, 600 watts each output. Cell site, they were built for 800 and some odd meg performance, and to move them to 902 megs is a fairly simple process. So solid-state, high-power amplification running on 28 volts nowadays is rather easy to put your hands on. But you got to be a little bit careful. Those amplifiers will want to see a pure 50-ohm load. And until you get that duplexing filter properly aligned, it could be giving you a pretty high standing wave ratio, which could damage a solid-state amplifier. So that's the one place where you could create some smoke and flames. So at the high-power level, that's one place where you don't do three-cavity alignment on the transmitter side with a solid-state transmitter. Some of them don't have very much output protection circuitry because they assume, the designer assumed, it's always going to be going into a perfect 50-ohm load. I think the next person who signed into the TechNet with a question was Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. And go right ahead with your question, Joe, K-2-R-I-W. Joe, you were earlier.
Yeah, I'm running a 5-watt HD on a discount antenna. That's all I have available for transmitting on here. No, I'll hold off the next week. I'd rather, it's a little easier to me if I can talk around a little more full flight and walk around and see if this HD. I only have one battery that's charged up with this radio. It's going to go pretty quick with 5 watts output.
I see. So I was hearing 5 watts there. If you go down to the 1-watt level, the battery lasts longer, but you're afraid you're going to be too noisy into the machine? Is that what you're saying, Joe? Go ahead.
No, this radio can't do that. This is a commercial HD. It's a Motorola MT-1000. It has 6 power level output. You can't change it. It is what it is.
Okay. And I think you're saying you don't have a spare battery to continue the conversation if you get started. You're afraid that it's going to fail you on the worst part. You want to give it a try and... worst comes to worst. Do you have a second handy talkie you can go over to when the first one stops transmitting?
No, I don't. I only have one. I'd have to put a battery in the charger, so I want to charge up. I have multiple of these things. All right, let's see. I did have a question, and the question was dealing with video. Actually, just a question on video. I've noticed on the some of the space flights, I think they'll give you a view off the space shuttle up. You can say like a fuel tank view, you're looking down. And I noticed that video does not degrade at all. My question is, what kind of modulation or scheme are they using? Because I've noticed you don't get any picture breakup from just about the time they launch, about it, maybe 30 seconds after they launch that view, to the time that you just about before they detach the thing and let it go by itself. It seems to work pretty, pretty good. And knowing how this digital TV works on the ground with a moving vehicle, it doesn't work, seem to work at all. It just made me kind of curious on how that whole scheme is going to work.
Okay, so during takeoff, yeah, there's cameras that look down the external tank and let you know whether or not a piece of foam is breaking off and things like that. Rather high resolution, high speed cameras. And to my knowledge, the majority of the video that NASA uses is FM modulated, at least when it comes to the command service module. The video was on 2106.4 megacycles, 2.1064 gigahertz, 2 gigahertz, a little bit more, is the actual frequency for the downlink, and Steve Meath, W6YFK, among other guys, built the equipment in his backyard that allowed him to directly listen to the video downlink when the spacecraft was on a high-gain antenna, even though the antenna was aimed at Goldstone. He in Santa Barbara, California at the time was able to get enough of that signal into his 12-foot dish and demodulated the FM demodulation. The big problem he had the first time he set it up during a conference in space on Apollo 15, I think it was. There was a space conference back to the United States, to the president, I guess it was. And the first time he made it all work, he realized the video he was getting was upside down. In other words, the FM modulation up on frequency was white picture and down on frequency was a black picture, and he had it backwards. The sync pulses were upside down. He couldn't block the picture. And so during that conference, he had to rewire his receiver, change the phase of the frequency discriminator in order to get right side up audio, in order to have the wife who was in the living room at the time with a video camera in front of the television set recording this thing that he was receiving live. So that's the way they were doing it from space. Now, when it comes to the launch, and that's what you're really asking, I think there's a very similar system there. I think it's FM modulated video. I believe there's a tracking set of antennas that follow the spacecraft as it launches from the Kennedy Space Center, launch pad 39A. So it really is analog in the past, analog high-speed FM modulated video on an S-band carrier is what I believe it was.
Repeater, timeout.
But I haven't, that's what I believe it was, Joe, but I haven't really kept track of that one. So I think it's going to take a little bit more research to find out how they do it, but you're absolutely right. There's no dropouts, there's no noise. They get a beautiful high-resolution picture throughout the whole launch, and they're able to take it apart frame by frame and find out if a piece of the foam of the external tank broke off and struck the leading edge of the space shuttle itself. That's about as much as I know. Drag your feet in case someone else on frequency has got some more smarts on this particular subject. So W2RYY with a little bit of delay. K2RYW in the TechNet.
Okay, nobody's picking that up. Okay, it's very interesting. I'm using analog FM modulation for the video. Somebody had told me something about some of the satellites, the early systems that used to evacuate the missiles. What I did notice was when the picture is going to either lose or they're going to change from satellite to satellite, you see the picture actually gets have black specks in the picture. Like the noise or regular video will go white specks, and then it goes black. I have a comment on the something we talked about last week about GCW.
Okay, make sure you talk a little bit louder, Joe, into your particular handy talkie. Your audio, your video, here we go. Your RF's a little bit weak, and so we want to make sure that the audio rides above the noise that we're hearing in the background at the same time. When it comes to communication in orbit, now the world is a little bit more different. In the early days, the downlink from a spacecraft in orbit around the Earth down to the Earth used to be done with downrange trackers. So individual ships stationed in strategic places during that orbit in the oceans were picking up that signal as it passed overhead. For the last, I guess, 15 or so years, almost everything is done with the TDRS satellite, TDRSS, Tracking Data Relay Satellite. There's three of those tracking data relay satellites every 120 degrees in space at a synchronous orbit 22,300 miles up, and it's a Ku band uplink between the space shuttle, the TDRS satellite, back down to White Sands, New Mexico, where it becomes demodulated, then sent back up on a commercial C-band or Ku-band satellite, and then distributed throughout the NASA network. That's the way it's done. Now, that TDRS signal going up to the satellite from the space shuttle, that very likely is a digital signal. I do remember seeing some of the early literature about the way the TDRS satellite bent pipe function worked, and I think that was digital. So as you go out of the window of observability of TDRS satellite number one, and you get picked up with TDRS satellite number two, and sometimes there's a dead zone in between the two in which you get a dropout for a few minutes. because of where the satellites are positioned. That's part of what's going on in that case. I think you're saying you've seen the handoff between one satellite and another when you watch NASA Select. That's what I think you're saying, Rich.